This week, Mark Steeds from Bristol Radical History Group takes us through the RAC, the SMV and the SSC, that is, the Royal African Company, the Society of Merchant Venturers and the South Seas Company, to you and I, with a look at the possible legacy of the slave trade here in Bristol and having a permanent memorial, a kind of history hub of some sort. I'm joined now by Mark Steeds. He's a member of Bristol Radical History Group, behind one of their pamphlets, or one of the co-authors of Cry Freedom, Cry Seven Stars. Now, Mark, what are the Seven Stars?
The Seven Stars, the plough in the sky, if you like, a navigational aid. A couple of pubs in Bristol were named after that. In the countryside, they're called the Plough. And it's special significance in Bristol because the one pub, the Seven Stars, in St Thomas Lane, was where Thomas Clarkson came in 1787 to start his great campaign to try and get the slave trade abolished.
So whereabouts is that in Bristol? And who was this Thomas Clarkson chap?
Well, commonly it's next to the Fleece, just off of Victoria Street there. And Thomas Clarkson was, some people call him Wilberforce's foot soldier, but he was more than that. He was the man who did the first real human rights campaign to get the slave trade banned, as Samuel Taylor Coleridge called him, the giant with one idea, the moral steam engine, he called him. Yeah, he was the kiddie. He was really the man that made it happen.
How did he do it? How did he get the slave trade abolished?
Well, he campaigned vigorously. A lot of things came into their favour at the same time, petitioning, pamphleting, that sort of thing. When he came to Bristol, he was introduced to Landlord Thompson of the Seven Stars by a Quaker called Harry Gandy. And these people were great organisers, and they sort of backed him. And with Thompson's help, he was able to go to all the sort of sailors. He was introduced to various sailors. He realised their conditions they were kept in, the way they were being put onto ships against their will. They were being kidnapped, shanghaied, and all the rest of it,
This is just the sailors, let alone the slaves.
Oh, yeah. And he was able to go to the customs house in Bristol and see for 1786 that of the 1,000 sailors employed in the slave trade in Bristol at that time, only half of them came home. 250 deserted, and the other 250 actually died on it. People did not want to go on it. It was something they didn't want to do.
But I'll just bring you back to how he actually got it abolished. Did he go around banging on merchants' doors? I mean, was there marches through the streets? How did he do it?
The pamphleting and the petitioning were great things. But you've got to realise that the vested interests of the West India merchants was huge. The money was huge. Even in those days, if you voted against them, you would lose your franchise, if you lot. You would be put out of business. All sorts of tricks they used to go against it.
Is this the merchant venturers or who?
People like the merchant venturers. Most of the West India merchants were merchant venturers. Those people with vested interests. They were a minority, but they had a real stranglehold on the power in the city. And it wasn't just Bristol, it was Liverpool as well. After he left Bristol, he went to Liverpool and he was nearly assassinated. You know, a very brave man. He fought these people all over the place.
Can you just paint a picture of this Thomas Clarkson guy? What was his background? And who was he?
Well, he was a clergyman from Wisbeach in, I forget where, I think it's in Cambridgeshire. He went to Cambridge. His dad died young, but he was fairly wealthy. He went to Cambridge, and he was impressed by the works of a chap called Anthony Benezet, who was a Quaker abolitionist who was based in America. He read his writings. He was stirred up by that. And as it happened, his lecturer at Cambridge wanted him to, he set all of his students an essay competition about the slave trade. His tutor was against the slave trade as well. And using Benezet's works, he did his essay. That became a best-selling pamphlet as well. With that essay, it stirred him up. This was 1785. He'd sort of sat down and said, I must do something about this. He didn't quite say I am the person, but it stirred him up so much to say that someone must put this tragedy to an end, and it set him on the road.
But you said he was up against vested interests. Just how much money were merchants like Edward Colston and etc. making from this trade?
Colston predated him by 80 odd years, but the money was fantastic. It was Oi Colston made £170,000 out of his dealings with the slave trade, effectively. And when he died in 1721, in today's terms, that would be worth £500 million. They were making a triple profit on what they were doing. You know,
how do you mean a triple profit?
A triple profit. They were supplying the goods to trade with the Africans for the Africans to then be put on ships. They were supplying the ships. They were insuring the ships. They were then taking them off to the Americas, to the West Indies. They were then selling the slaves, and then they were buying produce back to then bring it back to Britain.
And is this the Royal Africa Company? And what was their relationship with Bristol's merchant venturers?
Well, the Royal African Company was really a 17th century construct. The Society of Merchant Venturers were against them in the early days of the slave trade, and the SMVs only really got into it in 1698 after petitioning for 40 years to get involved with the African trade. As their power grew, so the Royal African Company's power decreased. But they were all in the trade together, if you like. And then after the RAC, or in tangent with, or in parallel with the RAC, you then got the South Seas Company, who managed to get the Asiento, the sole rights to trade with Africans for the Spanish Empire. They got that in 1713, thanks to a Bishop of Bristol who managed to negotiate that. And that ensured then for another 30 years, in addition to what they were supplying to the British Empire, or fledgling British Empire, they were also supplying to the Spanish Empire.
So do you think we're right to concentrate on Edward Colston as one of the key people in this trade?
Well, he's been over-memorialised in Bristol, so he is everywhere. There's over 28, 30-odd things named in his honour, and you'd think no one else existed in Bristol. So, yes, you are right to have a look at Edward Colston, but you also, in fairness, you should be putting other people up on pedestals, people who fought it, like Hannah Moore, people like that, local
people.
So
who was she?
Hannah Moore, she was a playwright, she was an educated lady from Fish Ponds, born in 1740, very rare for a woman to be educated in those days. She was a very popular writer. She turned her back on the theatre and became interested in evangelicalism, and through John Newton, the great anti-slavery campaigner, former slave ship captain, she got interested in the campaign to ban the slave trade.
Well, that's amazing. So a captain actually turned almost like a poacher turned gamekeeper.
Oh, exactly right. Well, quite a few were. Harry Gandy were. John Newton, he was the fellow who ended up to be a great hymn writer. He actually wrote Amazing Grace, and that became the anthem of abolition.
Eventually it was down to Parliament to decide, but before that, Colston himself became an MP, didn't he?
Yes, he was. 1710, he was Bristol MP. A crucial time. He used his experience on the RAC with the Asiento, and he no doubt helped get that treaty through that enabled the South Seas Company to thrive. He did various things while he was while he was an MP. Yeah.
What about the potential to remember this? Because I know you've been to Nantes recently in France. What was Nantes' role in the slave trade, and what did you find there?
Well, Nantes was like a French Bristol, if you like. It was an inland port, in their case the Loire rather than the Avon, and it was a stronghold. Many voyages set off from Nantes. They had the same sort of merchant structure, if you like, as Bristol. Over 2,000 voyages went out, which is another similar amount as to what happened in Bristol. But in Nantes, they've looked at it, looked at the situation, realised they needed to reconcile that part of their past, and without pointing any fingers, they put 8,500 square metre part of their quayside over to a memorial park and a proper memorial as well, set down into the quay.
So that sounds quite big. What's actually there? You visited it recently.
Well, it's a landscape park. It was sort of part, again, like Bristol, they've gone through schisms of change since industry's gone out of the place. So they had this spare bit of land. They were shipbuilders, just like Bristol were. And they decided to use part of it as a memorial park and as a memorial. And it's beautifully done with plaques setting glass into the quayside, a bit like a ship's hull going into the quayside with the river on one side. And they've actually got a place where you can remember and reflect, which is something we're crying out for in Bristol.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, it's peculiar. I mean, I've visited the M Shed, which has got a very small exhibition about slavery and Bristol's involvement, but doesn't even mention the Merchant Ventures anywhere in there. I mean, it's got some facts and figures. It does seem that there might be an argument for something similar to Nantes here in Bristol. Is there anywhere that anyone's looking at the moment as a potential?
Yes, there are. There's some old dockside buildings that would be ripe for making a proper museum and sort of memorial, right next to Redcliffe Bridge, actually. They're the last buildings that haven't been sort of developed, if you like. They go back to 1883, and they'd be a perfect candidate if the council wanted to move away from its penchant for bars and restaurants.
Now, local people around Welshback aren't really happy about having more bars and restaurants either.
No, they're not. And they see that building as a history hub. And what perfect history than the reconciliation of the slave trade?
Some would say, look, this was a horrible time in Bristol's history, best forgotten.
You can't forget it, no. And it would be wrong to forget it. It goes on to this day. I mean, and so many great Bristolians put their lives on the line for it.
You know, Hang on a minute, the slave trade was abolished 200 years ago.
Well, the trade was abolished 200 years ago, but emancipation didn't come until 1833. 1834 it got passed in Parliament, and in 1838 you finally got a cessation in slavery, as it were. But in order to circumvent that, the merchant venturers, again, if you like, they were shipping people over from the subcontinent, India, and from Hong Kong, coolie labour, they were calling it, and they were supplanting the slaves who were now trying to work for money. They were supplanting them with indentured labourers, if you like, again, coming from the subcontinent, as I say. And they'd gone 200 years and thousands of miles from indentured labourers from Britain going out to indentured servants coming in again, you know, and it was all the while is for these people to make money.
But even Cabot and the slave trade, Cabot's reconnaissance of genocide in North America and the slave trade that followed it is not the start, is it? Because actually slavery in Bristol goes back to Saxon times.
Yes, it does, yeah. St. Wolston got the slave trade banned in Bristol in 1090.
Good old St. Wolston, well done.
Yeah, patron saint of peasants and vegetarians, yeah. And you don't hear about him in the middle of Bristol. It's wicked. But it wasn't only the Saxon trade. You mentioned Cabot. It was more his son, Sebastian, who was involved. He went into the employ of the Spanish and ended up in Brazil. He shipped Africans to Brazil. He took Amerindians and brought them back to Seville and had them as his house slaves, if you like, you know. So if you could point the finger at Cabot, it's more his son than John.
But let me drag you back to before 1066. Where was that Saxon trade taking place, and what, you know, why was it Bristol the hub?
Bristol was just one of the hubs. Chester was another place. I mean, at the time, the Vikings controlled Dublin, and they made Dublin the market, the mart for their slaves to go out through the Viking Empire. They had good contacts with Bristol and Chester, as I say, for getting slaves over there. This is the poor of Bristol, the people who'd lost their possessions, the street urchins, if you liked. Wolston mentions it, actually. He preached every Sunday for months on end in the slave pens, which are now in Baldwin Street, but it was the old course of the River Frome. He preached there, and they had this, you know, it was the youth of England going out with blonde hair and everything, all shackled up. And they had a nasty habit of putting the young women with child, you know, adding value to their cargoes, you know, despicable tricks that they would do again 500, 600, 700 years later.
Amazing.
And what always gets me, if it was bad in 1090, why did they resurrect it again 1590, 1690, 1790? You know, what was the moral, where was their moral compass?
Well, a lot of people today would say they're in wage slavery with, I mean, maybe pushing a point, but with ridiculously low pay and rents that they simply can't afford to pay. So they ended up with getting paid, sometimes even for a full-time job, less than their cost of living.
Yeah, it's wicked.
So, I mean, is it? Do you think it's stretching a point to compare the slave trade to that sort of modern economic slavery?
No, I don't think it is, no. I mean, one of the criticisms of the abolitionists, like Wilberforce and so on, was they cared more about the slaves than they did for the young of Britain going up chimneys and so on. In fact, it wasn't until 1875 that the Factories Act spread out of the cotton factories to all child labour. So all of a sudden, children up to the age of 10 were made to go to school. That didn't happen until 1785. You know, that's a long time after emancipation came to the West Indies.
Why is it, do you think, that Bristol still hasn't actually got a history hub or something that can show the full spread of the city's involvement with slavery over the centuries?
I don't know. It's very disappointing. It is. I mean, several times they've had an opportunity to do something, like with the Festival of the Sea, and they didn't even look at the slave trade when they were doing that. They had, again, another opportunity in 2007, but it was muddied. You know, people didn't know what they were celebrating for whom and by whom. You know, it's all.
Now we've got
No direction. No one's come along and said, you know, this is something we must do. You know, this is our past. This is our future.
We've got a West Indian mixed race mayor now, Marvin Rees, Labour mayor. Do you think it's going to make any difference?
It'd be a great opportunity for him to get in and do something. Yeah.
Is he interested in this? Do you think?
I don't know. I honestly don't.
Well, we shall find out.
Yeah. Okay. I hope he is.
And Mark, whereabouts can people find Bristol Radical History, both online or actually in the flesh?
Well, they do various events every year, all sorts of things they put on for people just to come along, like the Cube and all sorts of venues that they can get hold of. I mean, if they had a proper history hub in Welshpack, they could have that as a sort of community space. But the best place is on their website, which is all the W's, brhg.org.uk.
And if the people are interested in supporting the History Hub, is there anything they can do?
Just talk about it. Just put letters to the paper or you know, come in and talk to you, Tony.
Okay.
All sorts of things.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.